Hello, everyone, and welcome to the second episode of Scholarly Peers podcast. In this series, we aim to invite early career researchers, peer reviewers, and experienced journal editors to share their stories, their experiences in journal peer review. And in this second episode, I'm very happy to have Dr. James Wood with us. Nice to have you with us, James.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, can you briefly introduce yourself and maybe your experience in journal peer review?
Okay, so my background is as an EAP practitioner, English for Academic Purposes. And in 2012, I was working on the UCL Precessional. And I had a student who, despite receiving extensive feedback that she needed to make some massive changes to her draft, made some minor amendments to spelling and grammar, handed the essay in, and then subsequently failed the course. So that led to me getting really interested in why students use feedback and why they don't. So I started my doctorate in 2013 at the UCL Institute of Education to investigate how to help students to engage with and use feedback. And that expanded to peer feedback, socio-constructive learning designs mediated by technology. And then I got a permanent role at King's College London, got married to a Korean woman, had a baby, moved to Seoul National University in South Korea, finished my doctorate here, published some articles, and around that time I also started doing peer review. So peer review is very interesting, and I've read your articles with interest because it's very much related to peer feedback. And so a lot of the things that apply to student feedback that I've been researching also apply to scholarly peer feedback as well. Yeah, so that's basically my background and experience of peer review. Probably since I handed in my own thesis, I've published two Q1 SSCI journals, and I have others in the pipeline. And I've probably done about 12 peer reviews altogether.
Okay, that's very impressive. I mean, with all the different things, you know, in life and publishing and doing peer review, that's really, really impressive. So can you share with us some of your unforgettable peer review experiences as an author first?
So my most memorable experiences probably come from my rejections. So one article has been rejected a couple of times. So I've had different peer reviewers' reports on it. And an interesting thing is that none of the reports ever agreed with each other. So it's interesting to find how, you know, different scholars have got very different opinions about what constitutes quality or something that's appropriate for a journal. But it also means that as I got one rejection for a certain reason, I've probably been able to improve on that particular aspect of the article. It also makes me think that even if the article, I think the article is quite good, and I think it does make a contribution to the literature, but it could still be positioned in a more attractive way that kind of fits the times. So I will be kind of rewriting it and repositioning it for the kind of focus that I think will attract a positive result in peer review. So the last rejection I got for that article, the first reviewer said it was well written and made a very useful contribution, and then picked out some areas for clarification. But reviewer two picked out areas where I hadn't followed APA guidelines, but the journal is actually a Chicago journal. So, you know, there was some interesting mismatch there. And the rest of his review was mainly proofreading and kind of pointing out areas where the language could improve, and not so many content comments. So the suggestions were good, but I have to admit that I thought that this article was making a good contribution, and I wanted to get it into the pipeline. And I thought that I could go through with a kind of fine-tooth comb during the peer review process. But I learned from this that some reviewers will kind of fixate on language which is not quite as concise as it could be, or that doesn't collocate quite as well as it could. And that might actually lead to a rejection. And in my own experience of peer review, if there are language errors or writing that could do with a polish, I tend to just point that out. And I assume that they'll, you know, I point out some examples of the grammar errors that they're making or areas where their writing could be more concise. And then I suggest that they resolve that before final publication. So I never imagined that it could get rejected for not being, you know, finally polished. It was already fairly good, I think, but it could have been better, I do admit. So that was a learning experience for me that, you know, some reviewers will kind of just focus on the mistakes that they see rather than the kind of substantive parts of the article.
Mm-hmm. Right. It's very interesting to listen to your experience, and you name your unforgettable experience as those related to rejections and kind of transform that into a formative learning opportunity for you. I mean, to improve the article. And also, I think later you will talk about how that inspires you to review as a reviewer later on. So I think it's usually people talk about successes, you know, acceptances of their papers, you know, on Twitter and everywhere. But it's important to remind ourselves that rejections are normal, and we can take something away from it, take something from it as well, if we have the right frame of mind. Okay, so let's turn to your role as a peer reviewer. So do you have any unforgettable peer review experiences as a peer reviewer?
It's not so much an unforgettable experience, but it's a kind of quandary I find myself in as a peer reviewer. So I'm quite surprised by the different approaches that different reviewers take. I think because I'm an ECR, I tend to want to report on every single error that I find. And I want to make sure that I find all of the errors. I kind of feel like it's a responsibility. But that does often result in a report that is many pages long and many points long, which I understand could be overwhelming for some authors. But I did find out recently that while some of my reviews are several pages long, the other reviewer's review can sometimes be shorter, like a page or something like that. And those reviews tend to focus on kind of big issues, like a kind of overview of substantive issues, but then they don't necessarily go into the smaller details. So it made me think that if two reviewers took that kind of approach to kind of briefly talking about strengths and weaknesses, then probably a lot of weaknesses might go forward into the publishing phase. So it's making me question whether, you know, two peer reviews is enough, or, you know, it's making me question kind of how effective the peer review process is. I guess that editors might want to find one reviewer who is very detailed and another one who's more experienced and maybe can summarize their review. So I guess there are ways it can be managed. But that's something interesting I'm finding in my own experiences. I really like it when editors send both reviews back so we can compare. You know, that is really an excellent learning opportunity. And I think the more we can do that, the more we learn. You know, because once we've graduated, we don't really have our supervisors to give feedback anymore. And our supervisors may not have given us feedback that was that critical in the first place, you know, if our writing in its original form was okay. So when we kind of critique other people's work and then get to see other people's critiques and where they overlap and where they maybe point out different things, that's really, really helpful as a learning opportunity. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, it's something that you only get if you're actually taking an active part in the peer review process. But it is something that kind of accelerates your learning as a scholar. So yeah, that's very interesting.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very true opinion. I mean, in terms of learning from other peer reviewers, not just learning from, you know, reading the author's work, but, you know, learning from other reviewers who may be, as you said, more experienced, and they may have a different approach to reviewing. And it's not always about which approach is better. It's always about something that we can think about and maybe we can adapt, so that's also something that I learned in the peer review process as well. You mentioned something about your own approach to peer review. Would you mind sharing with us, just through words, of course, not, we don't have pictures here, how your reviewer's report typically looks like?
In terms of my process, I first read the article fully, often through audio. I have an app on my phone that I can listen to articles, and I'll often listen to the article and kind of get a general impression. And then I tend to think about it for a few days or sometimes weeks until I've got time to deal with the article. Then I print it and I tend to make notes on a paper copy. Then I provide a summary of what I think the work is about, the general strengths, what it contributes to the literature, and then some kind of general summary of areas where it can be improved. And then finally, I go through the entire article on paper with a Sharpie, and I kind of circle things and write question marks and kind of annotate the draft. And then I turn that into the report. So it tends to be a very, very thorough process. It's quite time consuming. And I try to kind of spot everything that I can find. One thing that I've learned recently, I think it was reading your recent article with Shan Mason about your own approaches. And you were talking about the importance of the kind of emotional perspective. So one thing I've noticed about my own practice is that when I'm being kind of hypercritical, it's difficult for me to couch things in a nice way, because there's so much to write, right? So it's one of the reasons why screencasts are so great, because you can say much more. You can add those effective aspects in as you're kind of discussing them. But when you're writing and there's a lot to write, you know, those things kind of get lost a little bit sometimes. So the final thing I do is go over it again, thinking about how to couch my advice in a way that makes it seem more like advice and that's not being too transmissive or directive, but trying to make it more like a dialogue that I'm having with the authors, putting sometimes things that I wanted to say as a statement as a question, to give them some space to consider whether or not the advice is good. Because I am aware, I teach sessions on journal publication at Seoul National University, and I teach sessions on writing a defensible thesis and things like that. And I am aware that many of our researchers, and this is people who've done their PhD and are trying to publish, think that every single point that a peer reviewer makes has to be incorporated into their work. And so I don't think it's appropriate all the time for us to say that it should be like this, because we haven't had the time to think about it. We haven't had the deep thinking process that the authors went through. So we're not always in a position to say that this is what should happen, in my opinion. But I think we are in a position to question, to provide a question that encourages the authors to think about whether or not making this change would enrich their draft or not. And I don't do that all the time, but I do look for spaces where I can kind of initiate a dialogue with the feedback recipient. And at times like that, I wish that it could be a dialogic process. I wish that they could reply, ask me a little bit more about what I mean if I haven't been detailed enough. But unfortunately, the blinding process makes that difficult. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and in terms of effective encouragement, I've been lucky enough to have some preliminary peer review from Naomi Winstone and Karen Gravett. And they very kindly commented on a draft of my early work. And I was so impressed by the way that they gave the feedback in a way that was kind of constructive, but also actually boosted my confidence. So I was at a stage where I wasn't sure what other people would think about my work. And they were so positive and constructive, and managed to kind of helped me to work on my weaknesses in such a way that I was kind of positively infused afterwards. And I'm not sure if I've been as successful as they have in my peer review process, but I have been inspired by their approach to kind of really considering the effective aspects of an impact of my feedback message on the feedback recipients.
Okay, that's very interesting, and it made me think about how assertive we need to be as peer reviewers. Just imagine if we try to ask questions all the time. I mean, that would pose another problem to the editor and to the author. So should I do this? Are you saying I should do this or not? It's a fine line, and we have to strike about being open-minded and being assertive politely sometimes.
Yeah. So there are examples, for example, I noticed where an author says, the aim of this article is to do this because if we don't do this, then this can't happen. And, a lot of the times that's asserted. And so I can often be quite confident in saying, okay, give a justification for this. Don't just assert. But then other things, if you're suggesting other literature that could be included, that's a decision that they need to make, I think. So, it's a balance. I agree with that.
Yeah. And another interesting point I noticed from your previous response is you kind of experienced the double blind peer review model, like in the journal peer review process, and the open model of peer review, kind of with your colleagues, with Karen and Naomi commenting on your earlier draft. And you kind of commented on the positives of that kind of open model, that even they, there is advantage to them knowing you and you knowing them, that you are able to trust them, for example, and seeing them as very successful academics, and they're giving you very, very good feedback, and it kind of boosts your confidence. So it's kind of very interesting to me, like there are pluses of the open model, of peer review somehow if executed nicely. Right. Let's go to the next question. And I think I'm quite interested in this, about how you learn to navigate the peer review process. And as all of us know, that we're not taught what it is, how we should do it as authors and peer reviewers in our doctoral training. Definitely not. Maybe a talk, maybe a workshop, but nothing more. You mentioned some of the ways that you learn, for example, reading other peer reviewers' reports. What other ways do you use to learn or acquire the skills?
So I've been teaching academic writing for quite a number of years. I've taught at the undergraduate, postgraduate, and even at the postdoctoral level. So I'm helping people to publish their own work at SNU. And I think so much experience critiquing other people's work, you get a natural sense for what is logical and what needs to be added or taken away when work is too descriptive and it needs to be more critical. And going through the doctoral process and the thesis defense recently, I read a lot of books about what makes a coherent academic thesis. And I think that's very closely connected to what makes a coherent journal article, right? So the ideas about the quality of a journal article are very similar to the ideas about quality of an academic thesis. And so one of the reasons I've been teaching sessions on this is because I really want to keep a handle on all of the things that need to be considered in order to do good academic work. And so with those things in mind, I tend to go through and kind of give feedback in a natural way. There are some good guidelines online about peer feedback as well. So in my sessions about how to prepare your manuscript for publication, I show some of the Taylor and Francis guidelines. They've got like a PDF with a one-page PDF with questions to ask yourself, and then a more extensive one that explains what the questions actually mean. So I share that with the students that I'm teaching kind of publication science to. Those questions are also useful, but I don't exactly kind of print them out and keep them in front of me, but those are really the things that I do look for when I go through the process. And the whole idea about being able to defend your PhD thesis, or that idea transfers to writing into your PhD thesis answers to those questions so that they don't become questions in the first place. And it's the same when it comes to journal articles. So the kind of classic questions you get in a thesis defense: why did you choose this methodology and not another methodology? So that says that, okay, justify your methodology. So using these kinds of questions. And I really liked Trafford and Lechem's book, Stepping Stones to Defending Your Doctorate, because it's got a number of questions that you might be asked during your doctoral defense. And I think we can ask those questions about our journal article, and then we can try to preempt which of those questions might be kind of considered by peer reviewers to try to kind of strengthen them. And then I already mentioned the article you wrote with Shan Mason, and also the Twitter account you guys are running on scholarly peer review. So it's good to see what other people are saying, and it's good to kind of see other people's experiences as well. Yeah, so I think it's kind of a combination of those different things. Mm-hmm. But yeah, keeping in mind this idea of what is good quality in scholarly work, those kind of that evaluative judgment that you apply to everything that you see. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. So again, I think you mentioned something really, really inspiring. So you mentioned kind of the requirements of a doctoral thesis are quite transferable to, peer-reviewed journal articles, for example. So do you think that doctoral students are somehow equipped with the skills to handle peer review feedback? In a sense, not explicitly, but do you think that they are kind of prepared in a way? We'll talk about training later, but do you think that they are, to a certain extent, prepared for that process?
I think when they prepare themselves for their doctoral defense, they are preparing themselves for peer review as well. So when they start self-auditing, self-assessing, self-editing their own work, self-assessing their own work according to those doctoral standards and according to those peer review questions, that's when they're building up the expertise they need to critique other people's work. And I think in my case, because I've been teaching academic writing for so long and giving extensive formative feedback and extensive summative feedback on every single student draft that I've seen, that is what really equipped me. And that also helped me to ask critical questions about my own work and self-assess it, so that, that's helped me to raise the standard of my own work. Mm-hmm. So I think the more that you engage in peer feedback, the better. When I started in my doctorate in 2013, we were face-to-face and we didn't really have much opportunity to kind of build up a digital network. Mm-hmm. So after we weren't able to meet face-to-face, after I moved to Korea and after COVID-19, I think that's been a challenge for courses that start face-to-face and don't establish themselves online. Because I think if we'd been able to kind of regularly give each other peer feedback outside of those face-to-face sessions, I think that would have been incredibly constructive. Mm-hmm. But it comes down to teacher feedback literacy. So our teachers were not very savvy about digital teacher feedback literacy. And I think very few are. And I think very little has been written about digital teacher feedback literacy, and how teachers really need to know how to use technology to scaffold peer feedback communities. And I think that's something my work is kind of can be used in that way, to kind of show how teachers can help students to develop peer feedback communities. But I think that's something that we can do as PhD students. We can develop our own peer feedback communities and as scholars as well. So developing our networks of kind of colleagues and mentors and people who We can sometimes ask for help. Mm-hmm. You know, they often talk about getting a mentor. It seems like a big ask, you know, would you be my mentor? It's quite a big job, isn't it? Like regular meetings. And I don't really feel like I can ask any one person to be my mentor. So instead, I've kind of developed a network of people who, you know, with a lot of appreciation for their help. I know that one person is particularly good at, you know, critical feedback. One person is very good at maybe feedback on social material issues. Somebody else is very good at feedback on recipients, for example. And maybe I can sometimes approach those people. And also, I'd be, you know, very, very willing and hoping that I get a chance to reciprocate at some point.
Mm-hmm. Great. Okay. So yeah, we learned, we just talked about some opportunities that we can harness to develop our feedback literacy as peer reviewers. Let's talk about some less fancy aspects of peer review. Any challenges or struggles you face in the peer review process, both as authors, as an author and a peer reviewer?
Sometimes peer review can be a little bit vague. And there, the idea of open peer review, where you could ask, you know, Naomi Winstone's articles with her colleagues show that, you know, some barriers to feedback are not understanding feedback and not knowing how to apply it. I can't say that I've had that issue, but sometimes it would be nice to talk to a peer feedback provider about whether or not their peer feedback should be put into my article. I've actually disagreed with quite a lot of the peer feedback I've received, and I've made a case for why I disagree in the nicest possible way, and yet my articles have still been published. But it would have been nice to be able to have a discussion with the peer feedback provider to kind of see if I can convince them my way of thinking. That would kind of remove some of the risk of the process. Mm-hmm. So the way that peer feedback is a challenge. I've also been asked to review some quantitative work, which I feel I'm not particularly qualified to do. But I think that those authors think, okay, if I know something about technology-enhanced learning, if I know something about technology-enhanced feedback, and this is somewhere in that field, this person is still a good person to review this work, even if they're not a quantitative specialist. And so I've kind of made it very clear that I'm not particularly well placed to decide whether the t-test they've done and the different kinds of analysis they've done were the most appropriate things for that particular article. But in many cases, it's the framing of that method anyway that has the problems. Mm-hmm. And those are the areas where I have been able to contribute. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And then I think Yuso Nieminen has mentioned this on Twitter sometimes, but sometimes it's the kind of paradigm war in the feedback. So a lot of the critical feedback is coming from a kind of quantitative paradigm that's being applied to qualitative work. So for example, they say, oh, so you had more than one intervention. So how do you know that your qualitative results come from that intervention that you're kind of showcasing? And okay, that's the wrong question to ask, because we're not looking for cause and effect here, right? So it seems unfortunate that a lot of peer reviewers are very well trained in quantitative methods, but maybe not always as aware of qualitative methods. And so that can sometimes lead to kind of problematic advice in the peer review process.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah, I think that's very true, and it all depends not just whether we can find suitable reviewers, but whether the suitable ones are available. You know, from a very practical perspective, and you know, editors may have to locate people who may not be 100% perfect fit, but still can contribute to the process. But yes, I think these are challenges that we all experience as peer reviewers and authors. let's talk about support and professional development for journal peer review. And we kind of touched on that previously, but it's something that is quite dear to my heart because I think not enough has been done to support early career researchers and doctoral students who are required to a certain extent to publish, but they are not equipped to face the most crucial process in academic publishing. So any ideas? And you mentioned something that you did for your university, you're still doing for your university about preparing doctoral students and ECRs. What other kinds of support do you think would be valuable?
Well, incidentally, there was nothing in my doctoral program at UCL IOE about peer review or about publishing. And yet we were writing, you know, 7,000 word essays on research design and, you know, literature reviews and things like that, which I think it was a bit of a lost opportunity that we could have been peer reviewing those for each other with a view to trying to get them published. I feel looking back that if they had encouraged publishing a bit more and encouraged it peer review among the cohort, that would have been fantastic for all of us who wanted to become academics. And so that happened a bit too late. So I think workshops for doctoral students about how they can get started doing peer review, how they can get started publishing would be excellent. So my very first peer review was for Cambridge University's student-led journal. So I never heard about anything like this at IOE, but I was invited to review for that journal. Mm-hmm. And so there was a PhD student editor, an assistant editor, and they were generally getting peer reviews from people who'd already graduated or close to graduation. And I think that kind of experience is excellent. It gives people an opportunity. And like I was saying, I think it would be great to have some kind of repository of first drafts, what the peer feedback was, how the published version differed, or maybe it never got published, maybe it kind of failed along the way. I know that it's difficult to kind of show our failures to each other, but I think that would be a remarkable learning opportunity if we were willing to kind of share what the article looked like at first and the kinds of critical feedback that we got and how we responded to that. In my own sessions, I can't really show what the peer reviewers said to me, but I can show my reply. Mm-hmm. And so in my recent session, one research track professor said that she believed that you have to reply to every single point positively. So you have to say, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this, I've done this. And she was really surprised to see that in my first article, I was politely refusing peer feedback. And so she, in her feedback on my session, she said, can we have another session about negotiating the peer feedback process where you talk about and give examples of how you can say no to a piece of peer feedback, because it's not always on point. You know, it's coming from the best possible place, we hope, but sometimes it isn't appropriate. And sometimes it can theoretically make an article worse as well as better. Mm-hmm. And so we need to be equipped with all of the skills that we need to give good peer review, to know when we need to hedge our suggestions, to know when we have certainty and when we don't, to tackle these epistemological questions. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we also need the tools that we need to, and for non-native speakers, it's often language tools as well. Mm-hmm. You know, what is an appropriately polite way of thanking the reviewer for their comment, but at the same time, offering a polite rationale for why you're not going to apply that to your work? I think these are all things that we need a lot more experience of, and it would be absolutely fantastic if there was some kind of repository of examples of that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I do actually share my first draft of my first published Q1 article in that session. I know it's a lot for people to read, but I think that if they do read it and they kind of see what happened with it in the second draft, I think there's a lot they can gain from that process.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, some really good ideas. I especially like the idea of the student-led journal, giving students the opportunity really to acquire some hands-on experience, but in a relatively low-risk environment, right? And I wonder, and I know Seoul National University has a journal with Springer, Asia Pacific Education Review. I wonder if it's just a personal question out of curiosity, whether the journal is used as a space also to prepare researchers in the university, for example, inviting researchers or staff or even students to review for the journal. Do you know anything about that? Or
I have reviewed for the journal, and I'm not really sure what their practices are. Unfortunately, I am a member of the university, I'm not exactly an insider in that department. I'd like to become more of an insider, but one thing that was very good about that experience was they sent me an article that had already been peer reviewed, and so they asked me to kind of review the review. So I could see the first reviewer's comments, and I could see how the authors had dealt with those comments, and then I could make my comments. And that was useful to see the whole process. I think I was able to learn quite a lot from that. Mm-hmm. So being asked to kind of check a second round process is a good opportunity, actually.
Mm-hmm. Okay, right. So I think our interview is coming to a close. Just to conclude everything, James, do you have any advice you'd like to give to early career researchers or doctoral students who may be thinking, I'm going to submit my first ever manuscript to a Q1 journal or to, do you have any suggestions for them?
There's so much to say here, really. So after I graduated and, doing a part-time doctorate, having a family, I was very busy. But as soon as I graduated, then it was just learning how to publish. And it seemed like quite a big cliff to climb without the support of my supervisors, which I then lost because I'd graduated and they were busy with other students. So I've actually put together a 2-hour session on this that's just full of resources that are out there. There are so many good books to read. There are so many kind of free resources by publishers about how to get started. And all of them give very, very good advice. I think there's a lot of pitfalls, and some of those pitfalls are not actually mentioned. So the very first thing I did was I didn't understand the blinding process. So I went into the system and I thought that the editor did the blinding process. So I didn't realize there was a drop-down list. So I think I submitted a journal that wasn't properly blinded, and it got rejected immediately. So then I wrote back to the editor and said, sorry, this is my first time. Would you accept a properly blinded version? And luckily they said yes. And that was my first and currently most successful article. So I'm really glad that I asked a question and got a second chance. So I think it's important to know that editors can be very helpful and very constructive, and they can give second chances if you do something wrong. But also learning about those pitfalls from other people is really helpful. And connecting with, I think we didn't know each other until I joined Twitter. Mm-hmm. And unfortunately my supervisors didn't have Twitter, so they didn't really recommend it to me. But then other people did, and I found that Twitter has been a fantastic professional learning network. So we connected and we had a chat, a kind of mentorship chat, which was really, really useful. And I went to conferences and I met Karen Gravett and Naomi Winstone face-to-face. And we had dinner together, and that was an excellent opportunity and helped us to build our relationship. As I said before, can we get a mentor? I'd love a mentor, but I'm not sure who has the time and, there's nobody provided in my institution, unfortunately. So if there isn't a kind of formal mentor, then yeah, peer mentoring and getting a network, as I said. And then I hope to be able to kind of pay that forward in the future.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. Thank you so much, James. I mean, what I take away from talking to you today is how you transform those rejections, potentially negative experiences into something that you can learn from, and ultimately succeeding in publishing articles in very reputable journals. And I think this is something that we need to talk about more, not just sharing our successes, but, you know, not failures, but our struggle and, you know, real life challenges in the process of peer review. So thank you so much, James, for